This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I am unwilling to give up, that I will start over from scratch as many times as it takes to get where I want to be.
You just want to make sure you will get knocked down, but just make sure you don't get knocked out.
So your only choice should be go focus on what you can control.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Kara Golden Show. Join me each week for inspiring conversations with some of the world's greatest leaders. We'll talk with founders, entrepreneurs, CEOs, and really some of the most interesting people of our time. Can't wait to get started. Let's go. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Kara Golden Show. I'm so excited to have my next guest here. We have Scott Tannen, who is the founder and CEO of Bowl and Branch. And if you are not familiar with Bowl and Branch, boy, you're going to be very excited to hear about this brand. And even if you are familiar with it, maybe you don't know Scott Tannen, although I think I've heard his voice on ads over the years. So you're going to be very excited to hear him speak about the brand. But it's the world's leading luxury bedding brand. And it was founded in 2014 with Scott's wife, Missy. And Bowl and Branch was one of the earliest direct-to-consumer brands in the soft home world of bed and bath products, and is the first ever 100% organic fair trade certified bedding company. So every product from their sheets to their down pillows is made sustainably. Very excited to talk more about that with a very transparent supply chain. And today, Bowl and Branch is one of the largest e-commerce first luxury home brands. And in 2019, I remember Scott and I were chatting, and he had just received a very large investment from a company called L. Catterton, and which is the largest, one of the largest, if not the largest, consumer-focused private equity firms in the world. So that was very, very exciting for sure. And more than anything, I'm a huge fan of Bowl and Branch. The sheets are amazing. The comforters, the pillows, everything is so amazing. So I'm very excited to do this interview, in case you haven't noticed. So welcome, Scott.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. Good to see you.
Yeah, absolutely. Very excited to see you. So first of all, I'd love for you just to catch us up on what brought you to become an entrepreneur. And then we'll get into Bowl and Branch. But I mean, what was it about your experience that said, I need to go do this?
You know, it's funny. I think I started my career in bigger businesses, in food and beverage. So I was at Nabisco, which became Kraft Foods. And probably because I was the right age at the right time and nobody else internally in the late 90s and early 2000s knew what the internet was, I became the digital marketing team for the company. So I became a bit of an entrepreneur within the gates of a multi-billion dollar operation at an age that I was way too young for anyone to have actually, that they should have given me any responsibility. They did. And so, you know, I spent the first decade or so working my way up the ladder, if you will, but doing it by, you know, first at Kraft and then at Wrigley, building the global digital organizations, right? So this is a case where I walked into Wrigley in 2005 and they said, you don't have a digital team. We're not even doing anything from a digital standpoint. Should we just build some websites? I'm like, all right, let's pump the brakes and let's talk about this for a second. But So, you know, I was evangelizing, I was doing a lot of the things that entrepreneurs do without having to spend my own money. And at a point at Wrigley, one of the things that we had developed way back at Nabisco was a gaming website, a gaming portal called candystand.com. And this was not just a small portal. This was something that was generating 20 to 30 million unique visitors a month. It was one of the 100 most trafficked websites on the internet and happened to have free games for kids that, you know, the mini golf course had, you know, lifesavers and things like that in it. So it was branded entertainment. And to make a very long story short, this thing got so big that Wrigley didn't know what to do with it because it was very expensive to host. But with a partner, we ended up acquiring the business out of Wrigley. And here, all of a sudden, I went from, you know, corporate guy to one of 15 people at a gaming startup in New York City saying, all right, we've got this asset. What do we do with it? And so that was sort of my first foray into being an entrepreneur. And once I got a taste of that, I loved it. I love the idea of sort of walking the tightrope with no safety net. And so that propelled me as I went along. We sold that company and I realized that, you know, walking back into a big corporate environment, I probably wouldn't have the autonomy that I might have had back in the early days of my career because everybody had caught up with that. So if I wanted to carve my own path somewhere, I was going to have to start from scratch.
How often have you thought about learning a new language only to be stopped by that memory of yours from the last time you tried to learn a language when it didn't go so well? Okay, maybe it wasn't a language that you were interested in learning, or perhaps all those poorly written textbooks in your sixth grade class weren't that well written after all. I have a great tip for you. It's called Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program around. Available on desktop or app, no matter where you choose to learn it or what platform you choose to learn on, Rosetta Stone works, and it truly immerses you in the language you choose to learn, quicker and easier than you ever imagined to. Maybe you're getting ready to travel abroad this summer and you want to learn a bit of Portuguese, let's say, before your trip. Rosetta Stone can help. I know this firsthand as I did just this before traveling to Portugal last year. I learned Portuguese through Rosetta Stone, and by doing so, I not only got a better grasp of the spoken language of Portugal, but it got me very excited for the trip itself before I went. They even have a true accent feature that gives you feedback on your pronunciation as you are learning too. They've got you covered. Rosetta Stone's trusted experts are the real deal. They've been helping people just like you for over 30 years, helping millions of people to learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, Arabic, Polish, and my favorite, Portuguese. The lessons are 5 to 10 minutes long and include practical exercises so that you can pick up the language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. No English translations either, so you really learn to speak, listen, and think in the language you are focused on, helping you get the long-term retention you are looking for. And who wouldn't want that? Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, the Kara Golden Show listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off, unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today. Thinking about what's for dinner, but you haven't had a minute to even think about it before now? Well, let's not make that mistake again. I have a tip for you. Factor. Stress-free, delicious, ready-to-eat meals, just perfect for spring and summer yumminess. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes or less. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, keto, vegan, veggie, or calorie smart. Factor has you covered. Discover more than 60 add-ons every week, too, like breakfast and on-the-go lunch choices. Snacks and beverages now too. Stay fueled and feel good all day long with whatever they are creating over at Factor for you. And the best part, each meal is ready to eat in just 2 minutes or less. And who wouldn't want that? Factor is your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Get started today and fuel up for your spring and summer goals. What are you waiting for? Head to factormeals.com/golden50 and use code golden50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code golden50 at factormeals.com/golden50 to get 50% off plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. That's code golden50 at factormeals.com/golden50 to get 50% off plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Yeah, I totally relate to that. It's hard to imagine once you've gotten the bug that you, you know, the autonomy of it, but also the I loved your analogy of a tightrope, because it for sure, it's a different feeling that maybe you get even when you launch a business inside of a large company. I mean, you're kind of, you know, living with one foot off of a cliff at all times. And it's, but it's definitely the dopamine kicks in for
absolutely
sure as you're doing it. So tell us in your words, why did you decide to start Bowl and Branch then? Where did this idea come? Were you always a big sheet lover, or what was the key?
I've always liked to sleep. And I was always really good at sleeping, better at sleeping than most things I do. But I mean, no, you know, yeah, it almost sounds like a joke, right? A guy from the gaming industry walked into a bar and started a sheets company. But, you know, so after I sold the business, I was doing some consulting and a little bit of investing and just became enamored with, you know, look, this is 2013, 2014. It was the early days of e-commerce direct to consumer. And I was just enamored with how quickly people with unique ideas could come in and on one hand, disrupt big businesses like places I had worked, these brands that had done the same thing for generations. And you know, suddenly the direct-to-consumer landscape leveled the playing field. It gave equal access to the consumer if you were creative enough and unique enough and had enough of a message for people to jump into. So I was really interested in that. And also, you know, the truth is, as Missy said, you're spending way too much time in the house playing video games. You got to go do something. And so I had a ton of ideas, a lot of really, really bad ones too. I had an idea for like creating a luxury toilet paper, which, you know, you can imagine how proud my family would have been to say that, yeah, you know, my kids say, oh, my dad makes toilet paper. But fortunately, I picked bedding. And the truth is, we were redoing our master bedroom, moving from a queen bed to a king bed. So, you know, as often happens with entrepreneurs, something happens in life that triggers an idea. And so, you know, in this case, I thought about bedding and I just became fascinated by the category. Like, we all participate in the category. Every one of us, regardless of our socioeconomic status. And yet when you think about it, there, especially if you look back to 2013, 2014, when we launched, there was no brand, right? The best that you could think of as a leading brand would be Bed Bath & Beyond, Macy's, right? And at that point, you're talking about retailers and private labeling. And so I found that fascinating. And I was sort of thinking to myself, well, why isn't there a brand? And what I kind of came to, if you think about the categories, think about like laundry detergent, like why is Tide the staple? Well, they're trusted. And what makes them trusted? Well, you know, my mom used Tide and my grandparents used Tide and whatever. So I'm just going to use Tide. And the same could be said for Kleenex or Gillette razors, or you name the sort of staple categories. And I realized as I thought about bedding, not only did I have no understanding of the category as a consumer, the only thing I thought I knew was thread count, which you can Google and in 30 seconds you find out thread count doesn't actually mean anything. And I was like, what if you actually created a brand that could be trusted? What does it mean to be a trusted brand in this category? And especially when you think about a category like textiles, nobody trusts textiles. The only thing most people that actually spend time to think about the textiles industry, the only thing that they really kind of arrive on is, I don't trust this industry, right? It's kind of slimy. And when you start digging into it, as I did, and I know you're an entrepreneur, you do the same thing. Like, there's no rabbit hole we won't jump into. And I jumped into the bedding rabbit hole, and I realized that the reputation the industry had, which was sketchy at best, was well-earned. There were a lot of sketchy habits, from misleading the customer to marginalizing the people that were making the product and all of those things. And so I started to realize, like, it wasn't just about trying to create a brand and create another bedding product. Like, there were so many there's so many bed sheets that have been around. The world didn't need another bed sheet. The world needed a better one. And the only way I was going to make a better one was to start by making a better company.
Yeah, definitely. Well, you have absolutely done that. So where did the name come from?
So if you think about, if you could visualize a cotton plant, right, the white puffy cotton fiber grows out of a shell, and that shell is called the boll, and the boll grows on a branch. That was probably one of 1,000 names that Missy and I had tried out, ranging from, like, you know, our grandparents' names and things like that. But you know, in truth, what really differentiates our company starts at the raw material. It's how we deal with raw materials. It's how we work with farmers. And so it felt really fitting to us that our name should reflect cotton. Because, you know, the biggest fundamental difference between us and everything that had been into market at that point was the fact that we were gonna source this stuff, grow this stuff, invest in the farming communities, and do it really sustainably.
So sustainability, you just mentioned that word, and you were very focused on that, very focused on the supply chain, being transparent as well. Why is that important today to this consumer?
You know, I think if you come all the way back to the point of building a trusted brand, right? And the notion of, we've been talking about transparency for a long time, and transparency essentially means when it comes to a business, where a business is going to tell you, we're transparent. I'll tell you everything I know. What often happens in this category is the companies don't actually know that much, because they don't really understand where the product comes from. So let me walk you through how any one of the department stores, even other bedding startups, how they work. Right now, this week happens to be Market Week in New York City. So all the large manufacturers from all over the world come to New York City, brands come in, and they walk into showrooms and they say, all right, model number 35 on the wall, I'll take 500 sets of that and 300 sets of this and 200 sets of that. And so they're buying finished goods that their label is being sewn into, and the same, you know, one department store versus another brand, it's all coming from the same, like, 5 or 6 factories overseas. And so, like, really simply, when someone's selling a sheet set that's made from Egyptian cotton, and this is how I started in my journey, I'm a history buff. I wanted to go visit Egypt. And so I was like, all right, well, Egyptian cotton's great. Like, let's go to the farm. And they're like, we don't. Turns out they didn't know where the farm was. Turns out the Egyptian cotton was grown in China, of all crazy things. And so, you know, that's part of my 2-year journey of figuring out this industry. And so I started thinking about, okay, if you really want to create a brand in this category, you've got to earn the customer's trust, which means transparency has to be core to what you're doing. But transparency where you don't know very much about the product or the process is worthless. So we decided to take transparency to a different level in that we also partnered it with traceability. So every single product that we make, I can trace back to the raw material. Literally, there is a tag inside of our sheet sets, every one of them. And we're actually about to introduce something called Origin Track, because we just had this idea that, why don't we expose this to the customers? We've been doing it since day one, where you can flip over that tag, enter in a lot number, and I'll show you, this is the farm it came from. This is where it was spun. This is where it was woven. This is where it was dyed. Here's where it was cut and sewn and finished. And so as part of that, when we expose that to the customer, we can then say, listen, we know everything about this product, everything from the genome of the cotton seed right through the finishing stitch and the packaging was an intentional decision that we made. And we stand behind that decision. And we're going to be open about it so that you can evaluate whether we've made a fair and just decision on behalf of the people in our supply chain or not. And so that was the essence of how we approached it.
So interesting. So when you started, when you decided, okay, I'm going to launch Bowl and Branch, how long do you think it took from the time you were actually thinking about it to actually getting the courage to go and do this? Because again, you were, your last company was really focused on bits and bytes, right? The
Absolutely.
The candy store versus
yeah.
physical goods. I mean, that was a massive, massive undertaking.
Yeah.
So how long before you actually launched, and how many SKUs did you have? Like, how did you think about, you know, that launch? And I'd love to hear those early days.
Yeah. So almost 2 years, believe it or not. And so it could have taken 4 to 6 months because the starting point, once I had the idea, well, sheets would be interesting, right? I could have gone to any of the usual suspects, created a logo, had them private label it and ship me finished goods. And so at the start, I was kind of going that path, but I was learning about the category. And the first thing I started to learn about was the cotton itself and just how much safer organic cotton was for the farmers, right? When you start learning stats as you go through it, the life expectancy of a conventional cotton farmer in India was 36 years old at the time. And I was 36 years old at the time. And that's because of exposure to the chemicals, pesticides. Like we drive, if you ever drive cross country, you see these massive farms in the US with all this infrastructure, and it's amazing. When you visit a farm in the developing world, it's a family that owns 2 to 3 acres. And they don't, you know, they probably don't have the educational background to understand the dangers of the chemicals that they're applying, which they're doing with a backpack as they walk through their fields and tending to it. They don't have irrigation. They have rain, and the rain washes those chemicals into the groundwater. They drink it. It's horrible. And so there's massive cancer rates. There's just so many issues that would depress your listeners if I got into all of them. But I just felt like that's a system. There's got to be a better way to look at the system. Everybody I talked to that was in textiles is like, well, the customer doesn't care. Customer doesn't care about organic. They don't care about this. And that may or may not have been true, but I, you know, Missy and I cared. And we're like, well, we're consumers too. So if there's a better way and something we could care about, then we've got to figure out a way to make it work. And so true story is that when we started thinking about this path of sustainability and truly, like, we weren't thinking sustainability. We were thinking about, let's just make the right choice, the human choice at every opportunity that we thought was best for everybody involved. I had met someone that worked at the Cotton Board, and he was sort of a friend of a friend and was like, Scott, I understand what you guys are trying to do. This is never going to work. Customers aren't going to pay for it. Your pricing's going to be a mess. Like, trust me, you know, friend of a friend, save your energy, save your money. And so I said to Missy, I'm like, all right, we're going to go down this path, and I'm going to write a book then. Because if we can't do this, the book is going to be called like Why the World Sucks or something like that. And so it was amazing. And this story of traceability came in the fact that we were documenting every single thing that we did, every conversation, everyone we were learning from, and we were approaching it like a research project. But what I started to discover in that process is that the traditional supply chain, we think of like the DTC language of cut out the middleman, right? As you know, okay, well, so buy it and basically wholesale it to a consumer, cut out the retail is what that means. But on the backside of a textile supply chain, there are so many middlemen that at every step of the equation. And when I started to be able to figure is, wow, if we could actually build and control a supply chain, we can suck all that cost out. So what we were ultimately able to do in building a supply chain is we built a supply chain where we are paying 2 to 3 times the price for raw materials that most of the conventional players are doing. We're paying more to every worker. We brought in fair trade to ensure that we're paying every worker above the living wage, right? The minimum wage is below the poverty line in India, as an example. So we're paying, again, 30, 50, 100% more. We're reinvesting into the communities. We're doing those sorts of things. And by cutting down transportation and by keeping that chain of custody ourselves, where we're working directly with the farmers, they're not paying interest because we're going to be their bank. And we cut so much cost out that we ended up with a cost of goods advantage on the category. So here we had a much higher quality product, complete traceability and transparency that's unheard of in whether it's apparel or anything. And I was like, this has got to work. Like, somebody's going to care because it's a better product, better price point, and everything about it is substantially elevated beyond the status quo. So, you know, about a year and change in was when we needed to place our first PO. And it's like, all right, I've figured everything out. I found all these different, you know, none of the traditional factories work. We're working with an apparel factory that we convinced to make bedding for us. Literally. And we brought in, fortunately, we're smart enough to bring in some experts that knew what they were doing, because at the time we didn't. And so, you know, but I sent my life savings to a random dude in India, you know, and hoped 8 months later a boat would show up with sheets on it. Thankfully it did. But that was the truth. I mean, I felt so strongly, and I thought, hey, worst comes to worst, I have bed sheets. They don't expire. Someone will buy these off me and maybe I'll get some of my money back. But, you know, I think like the typical entrepreneur, you get so focused and you become such a believer in it that you just have that drive to make it happen, takes over everything else. I felt it went beyond, hey, this is a great business to start, to this is a really necessary business to start.
Yeah, definitely. So you're direct to consumer first. You know, you launched with that. How many SKUs did you launch with? And like, what was sort of the thinking behind that?
So we launched with white and ivory sheets only, and three colors of throw blankets. So we had five items, and the sheets obviously came in a few different sizes. And the thought process when we had done some research is that white and ivory was about 70% of the market. It's actually lower than that today, but at the time it was about 70% of the market. And the throw blankets, we were just like, oh, that would be a nice thing so we could style the bed with it. We didn't have duvet covers. We didn't have pillows. We didn't have blankets. We didn't have anything. We just had white and ivory sheet sets and three throw blankets when we launched. And the, you know, I wish I could say there was a lot of scientific thought behind it. It was just, we were like, we only added the throw blankets because we felt like, well, only having two colors of sheets doesn't seem like enough. And when I was in one of the factories in New Delhi, I saw the weaving machine. I was like, can you make us some blankets? And Missy quickly designed a cable knit, and, you know, away we went.
Those are the best stories, right?
I know. It makes my planning
so
team
many
now
factory.
Cringe.
Yeah, I know. We have so many factory stories for sure. Those are really the best. So being an entrepreneur, I don't even like the term ups and downs. I feel like there's massive spikes, and yeah, Everybody talks about it in every industry. When you're on a high note, maybe, you know, you're excited, but you're also worried, right? Because you know something's going to happen. A piece of business is going to go away. Something like this. I'd love to hear a story where maybe you felt, you know, a really like challenging time that you weren't sure you were going to make it out. Maybe in the early days.
I have a great one for you.
Yeah.
So we launched January 20th of 2014. And of course, as what happens with most startups, your foot soldiers, which is your family, friends, you know, kid you were in nursery school with or whatever, everybody comes in and wants to support your business and buys the product and is chatting about it on Facebook. And so we get into sort of like mid to late February, and we'd sort of run through those people. We had gotten a little bit of press pickup of the press release, but each day I'm watching, you know, like if we got to $1,000 in revenue, I was like, that was a great day. And we started getting to the beginning of March, and we were going to go visit Missy's parents in Florida for spring break. And it had been like 2 or 3 days and we didn't have any sales. We got down, her parents had to be out of town. So we got to their place like 2 days before they got there. And I'm watching, we still don't have any more sales. Like the next day, Missy's like, don't tell my parents. They're going to lose their minds. Don't tell them. And I'm losing my mind and freaking out because I'm like, I don't have any money left. I'm not sure. Like, I'm trying to like do what I can. I just can't, like, I'm not sure what to do. And you know, meanwhile, anybody that called that wanted to talk about the brand, I'm like, hey, I'll talk your ear off all day. And an amazing woman whom I admire so much named Christina Binkley had called me a few weeks earlier, and she's a writer for the Wall Street Journal. And I had talked to her about the business, and she was she also taught a class, and she sort of didn't believe what I just said about how we could find this cost of goods advantage. She's like, it doesn't make sense that you're really selling this high of a quality of product at this price point. You must be losing a ton of money. And I'm like, I'm not. And she said, you know, gosh, I wish you could prove it. I was like, why don't I just open my books? I'll show you. And so I opened the QuickBook file. I send her, you know, a PDF. And to make a long story short, she calls me a week later. She's like, if I ever wanted to publish this, could I? I was like, my pricing and my cost of goods? And she's like, yeah. I was like, why not? Sure. And I didn't think anything of it. So anyway, Missy's parents come into Florida. We've had no sales yet another day. It's like six straight days, no sales. And I'm in full freakout mode. And they surprise us because it was our anniversary. And they said, we're sending you guys. They live in Naples. They're like, we're sending the two of you to Miami. We're going to watch the kids. You guys just get a night away. You've been working so hard on this business. So we drive from Naples and we go across Alligator Alley, which has no cell reception. It's literally like out of a movie. As I come out of no cell reception, my cell phone starts blowing up. And most of the texts are from my meathead friends. And they all just say, dude, or something like that. And it turns out Christina had posted a video on WallStreetJournal.com about Bull and Branch and our pricing model and said, I'm going to actually run a story about this in the paper tomorrow. Well, right then we had like, I don't know, $5,000 in sales, something that I was like, this is the greatest day of my life. By the time I got to the other side of Alligator Alley, wake up the next morning, I run down to the news cafe. On the front page of the Wall Street Journal is a banner across the top that says, what goes into the price of luxury sheets? The back of the front section starts a 2-page article about us. We sold out of everything in our warehouse by noon that day, and I didn't retire a waiting list on product for almost 18 months after that.
So Miami was not a relaxing
place. No, I mean, I was like, first of all, like we ended up there. We didn't know we were there. It was Ultra Music Festival, and we're the nerdiest people in the world. And it was like, but it was crazy. And it was one of those things where, you know, you know, like that tingly butterfly feeling you have around, and you've put, like, it'd been 2+ years and I put everything in my life, forget about money, but just all my emotions into this. My friends, my family, everybody knew we were doing this. And I felt like we were failing. I just felt like we were failing. And all of a sudden, with no warning, I felt like we were succeeding. And I wish I could say it's been smooth sailing since. It certainly hasn't. But that was just a moment that kind of reminded me that you know, look, there's some higher power up there that is driving everything. And in this case, like, you know, when good fortune happens and you roll with it, like it's amazing. And that's the drug, that's the dopamine hit of being an entrepreneur, is that, like, they're really, you know, it was just Missy and we're sort of looking at each other like, holy cow, did we kind of do this? Like, are we doing this? Like, this is happening. And it was an amazing feeling.
So what did you do at that point? Like, how long did it take you to be, I would guess you told everybody you were out, but you would be back in stock soon? Or
so I started by doing that, and that day literally customers, first of all, our 800 number would ring my cell phone. So I'm sitting there trying to like in a hotel room in Miami, like answering phone calls, and people are like, I don't care, you know, just put me on the list, put me on the waiting list. So we started letting people pre-order when they were in stock, and people didn't mind waiting 6-8 weeks for the product. And what was amazing is we actually got, you know, several $100,000 in interest-free financing from our customers. It was like Kickstarter before Kickstarter existed.
Right.
And so that enabled us to really invest in more product supply. And so we went from 5 SKUs in January when we launched. By September, we launched 87 new SKUs, which was also stupid. But we just went for it. And it was incredible.
That's such a great story. So how has Bull and Branch been able to succeed when many of your peers, have not. I'm sure, you know, you've maybe been surprised by other brands, maybe not all surprising, but sometimes you see competitors, you know, they look like they're true competitors and then all of a sudden they just go away or something implodes in the company. Like, how have you guys been able to do it the right way? And while you've seen others, obviously you don't know their whole backstory. It could be
right.
Their financing. It could be, you know, lots of different things, but I'm curious what you would say to that.
Yeah, I think some of it is good fortune. We were very fortunate not to need to get financing out of the gates. So we never had to think about shareholder value in the beginning where mm-hmm. we had somebody else telling us grow faster than you feel appropriate to grow, spend more money on advertising than you feel is appropriate. So we have been profitable from the get-go. We have been profitable every year of existence for 10 years. We actually broke even our first year. But other than that, we've been profitable. And that's just a core belief I have, which is that if I want to build a sustainable supply chain, then I need to make sure this business is around for people for a really long time. So we've grown really, really fast. But you know, there was, you know, like Casper is a great example in our category of somebody that grew super fast. And they've obviously, they're a public company. They've had their challenges as a result of it. So I think that's number one. I think the second thing is it's really the fact that we are incredibly focused on our product. Missy and her team design every single product we make. So why that's important is the customer is at the heart of what we're making. We don't make something without thinking about the customer's use and how it's going to wear, how it's going to last, and all of those things. And so it's hard to say whether or not other companies prioritize things in the same way. But I can tell you that we stand behind every product we make because we're not just going to launch a pillow. Our pillow took 2 years of engineering to get to. And so every product we make, whether it's our newest product or the first one we came out with, we hold that same sort of standard, which says this may be the only or the last touch point we have with a customer. And it's going to be the last if it's not great. So it has to be as great as the first touch point they have. And so we've been able to build our business, not just on new customer acquisition, but really on retention. We're when you look at our metrics relative to our category, we see 2 to 3 times the annual consumption on number of items they buy versus traditional players in the category. And so we have great loyalty. We treat our customers really, really well. Services, I mean, I take customer service calls all the time. It's the backbone of our business. And so I think that having that consumer mindset matched with this real intention for how we design and develop products and what we do and don't do has certainly been key to our success. And you know, given that others have you know, struggled to be as successful, I would think that maybe they spend more time on just advertising and growth rather than the core of their business.
Has there been a SKU that you've launched that, like, you're like, well, that was a really bad idea?
Yeah, bed skirts was one. We launched bed skirts in like the second year. Because we had a bed skirt on our bed, and literally, I don't know how many we sold, but it was like not many. Those lasted for a long time. You know, and the other, you know, there were times again. It's in the early days. You benefit from hiring much smarter people than you as you grow, but before you can afford to hire anybody, you make some really boneheaded mistakes, and I made them all. You can count on that. I mean, this isn't a product launch, but one of my favorite stories is, and you've seen our packaging. We're kind of known for this really exquisite, beautiful packaging. So we make it from an incredible company in Vietnam makes our signature boxes. And when we first had them sent to us, I was like, this is great. And they're pre-assembled and all they have to do in the warehouse is throw the stuff in. And I ended up shipping like 8 container loads full of boxes. And someone's like, why wouldn't you ship them flat? I was like, oh, that's a good idea. So we were, you know, there was a few times where we lost a couple bucks on that, on those sorts of things. But you learn, right? And I'm sure we'll have some more stinkers coming out there. But we'll try to avoid them.
Do you know Sean from Lovesack?
Yes. Yeah. He's great.
He's awesome. He was on our show a couple of weeks ago and talked about a very similar. He didn't. he figured he'd go and buy some a truck and little did he know, you know, that you have to have allowances for different types of measurements on things. So he talks about that too, that, yeah, you know, you make these mistakes and hopefully you only make them once, right?
That's the key, right? You know, you can make as many mistakes as you need to, just make each one once.
Yeah, definitely. So what's the most challenging aspect if you were to talk to another founder, like, no matter what industry they're in, it seems like there's a lot of similarities. I think there's definitely some differences between physical goods and the service business. But what would you warn somebody about starting their first company? Like, make sure to...
Yeah, I think make sure to be really thoughtful about who you listen to, because no one is short of advice. And look, advice is a wonderful thing. And I am very lucky to have more mentors than I can count. But, you know, it's a little bit like everybody becomes an expert. Well, you should do this or you should think about that. And I think at times, you know, the thing about being an entrepreneur is about having a vision and staying true to that vision. And so being able to have that filter on where you can sort of write down someone's idea and as they leave the room, you throw it in the trash. Like, you need some of that discipline to be able to stay true to your vision, or you'll feel like a ping pong ball all the time. And, yeah. And so, you know, you can, it's sometimes there's like a very loud voice in the room that feels very passionate and you want to listen. But there's times not to. And I think, you know, by the same token, you also can't be so headstrong and sure of yourself that you quit listening to folks, because, you know, we all drink enough of our own Kool-Aid. But, you know, by the same token, if you're honest with yourself and honest with your gut and you can block out some of the noise, I think it can be really helpful.
Yeah, no, I think that's great advice. So what are you most excited about? This is our last question, unfortunately, but what are you most excited about for Bowl and Branch moving forward?
I mean, look, we're 10 years in and I still think we're just getting started. You know, and I was talking to somebody the other day. I was like, look, the first decade is a proof of concept, is really what it is. Like, you know, so we're a $200 million business today, which is, you know, finally some scale, which to me means I can, from an ego standpoint, I can bump into people and they've actually heard of my company, which never, ever, ever gets old. It is amazing. But, you know, I think I don't plan on going anywhere. I didn't build this business to be sold. We do have investors. At some point, they'll want their money out and maybe I'll buy them out. Maybe we'll find other investors to take them. Who knows? You know, but Missy and I are incredibly passionate about this business. And I feel like I really finally have my team in a place where I have an incredible team that I love and trust and learn from. So, you know, I think about what do you do when you have this big starting point? And I look at all the things we're not doing today. We don't sell anything outside the US yet. We only have 6 retail stores. We're only just now fully starting to, like, at a high pace, roll out our partnerships with Nordstrom's and Bloomingdale's. You know, there's a lot of meat on the bone and we still play in a pretty narrow category. We launched furniture, but we're not intending to be a furniture business. You know, we are what we are, but, you know, are we yet, you know, we live in a lot of master bedrooms. Are we living in the whole home yet? You know, so yeah. I think there's a lot of excitement to me ahead of what happens. And the truth is, I mean, we've now contributed almost $2 million back into the communities from which we source our products. And so every time we place a PO, we place anywhere from 1% to 4% of the cost of goods back into an account that each group or each union, if you will, they call them a committee, fair trade committee. They can choose how they want to deploy that money, right? So they can, they've used them in the past to buy induction cooktops, which gives people the ability to have hot food in their homes for the first time, clean water supplies, medication during COVID, things like that. And so when I look at what we've been able to do growing from a very small scale to where we are today, and I think about what that's going to mean as we become a $500 million business, a $1 billion business, and the impact we can have around the world, that's the kind of thing. Like, I lost my mom right before I started this company. And I think what was in the back of my head was the thought that she gave me, which is, you know, how are you going to leave the world a little bit of a better place? And I'm still not sure how that happens, but I feel like, you know, when you could create a business that's doing really well, but more importantly is making just a super significant impact and creating an example for hopefully other entrepreneurs or even established businesses to know, look, you know, transparency is important. You know, the people at the Cotton Board that told me nobody cares, they do care. A customer loves the fact that they can, they're not just saying, you know, we don't want to just talk about our sheets at a cocktail party. But if you talk about a company that you've gotten involved in, which frankly, the customer has enabled all this goodness to happen, that's powerful. And that's the kind of thing that, you know, that's why I love Patagonia. That's why I love brands like that, that do so much good in the world. And so, you know, there's so much that has me excited. It's a long answer to a short question, but I'm pumped for the future.
I love it. So such a pleasure, Scott. Thank you so much for your insights and a great conversation. We'll have all the info in the show notes, but Scott Tannen, founder and CEO of Bowl and Branch. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Kara.
Thanks again for listening to the Kara Golden Show. If you would, please give us a review and feel free to share this podcast with others who would benefit. And of course, feel free to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode of our podcast. Just a reminder that I can be found on all platforms at Kara Golden. I would love to hear from you too, so feel free to DM me. And if you want to hear more about my journey, I hope you will have a listen or pick up a copy of my Wall Street Journal best-selling book, Undaunted, where I share more about my journey, including founding and building Hint. We are here every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Thanks for listening, and goodbye for now.